Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 10th, 2010. Coming up on the show, we have some last-minute tax tips to get you in tip-top shape for the new year. And why do you think we buy things that we eventually regret? Well, it's because marketers want us to.
Everything is calculated to make us purchase things, and then also for us to be constantly dissatisfied with the purchases that we make so we continue to buy.
Buyer's remorse, buyer's regret. And here's one thing people should regret: not sending their regrets or any response to a party.
Everyone is kind of like a fifth grader, and you are their mother who's saying, "Have you practiced your piano yet?"
Those stories and more coming up. But first, time to take a break from all the holiday hoopla and consider some end-of-the-year planning for taxes. All right, it's not as fun as shopping, but trust me, making a few moves now can benefit you big time come tax day, especially once the debate over the Bush-era tax cuts is resolved. Enrolled agent Frank Deegan has some tips for all of us, offered pro bono, no less. First up, I asked him about the home improvement tax credit.
People still have a few weeks left before December 31st to get storm windows, storm doors, insulation purchased and installed in their homes. The credit is 30% of the first $5,000 of expenditures, so it maximizes at $1,500.
Yeah, probably a little late to be putting solar panels on the roof at this point, right?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, or even running out and buying energy-efficient automobiles. Most people don't in the last couple of weeks make up their mind just on a whim to do that.
One of the other issues, of course, is making sure that you max out your retirement account. Are there new levels for that this year?
Well, the level for 401k, 403b is $16,500 for most taxpayers.
Okay.
If you're 50 or over, you can have a catch-up. Those are all out of payroll, so you must, if your company will allow you to make a change, in order to maximize, you have to do that at payroll by December 31st. If you have an IRA, for example, that's a little different. You can't contribute that until April 15th of 2011 for 2010 credit.
I know that there's been a lot of confusion about Roth IRA conversions. This is where you can convert a regular IRA to a Roth IRA, which means pre-tax to post-tax, right?
Correct. Up to $100,000 was, people couldn't do it. So this year is golden for anybody who wants to do it. But there's also a second reason why you may want to do it. And that is that the income that you will have to pay tax on, because don't forget, as you said, it was pre-tax to post-tax,
yeah,
can be paid over your 2011 and 2012 tax returns. Though the taxpayer can make an election to report all the income on their 2010 tax return, if they so choose. This is a very tough question to give advice on. You know, you hear the classic line, speak to your tax advisor.
Right.
And I think this is a real one where you really need, because depending on your age, your goals, and so on, some people may want to do this, others may not.
Okay. Well, then we'll go ahead and say that line. Check with your tax advisor, right?
Absolutely. Hopefully an enrolled agent.
There you go. Okay. Now, also flexible spending accounts. This is the time of year when people are running out to the drugstore to make sure that they spend down those accounts, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a rule called use it or lose it. At one time, December 31st was the absolute deadline. A couple years ago, the government did allow employers to institute a grace period up to mid-March. It was not a requirement. It's an option. So your listeners may want to consult with their human resources department. The one thing of note that your listeners should be aware of is that in the year 2011, there is going to be some change as to what is reimbursable under a flexible spending account.
Let's move on to charitable contributions. Anything changing here, or is this, you know, pro forma?
No, it's pretty much the same. The one thing that is required, that every contribution you make, regardless of amount, must be documented. You are allowed to take a deduction on your 2010 tax return if you postmark the contribution by December 31st, mail it to the charity, or you put it on a credit card. A lot of folks don't realize that if you put it on a credit card now in 2010, you may not be paying it to 2011 or 12 or 13 or 14. Who knows?
Well, but if you listen to this show, you know you better pay it off next month. And finally, you know, I think a lot of people start taking a look at their federal taxes at the start of the year. But is this also a good time to take a look at your withholding?
Yes. A lot of taxpayers don't believe you, but the worst thing in the world is to get a refund. Because
right.
basically, whose money are you getting back?
Yeah, you're giving Uncle Sam a loan, right?
Yeah, so one thing to do is if you are getting a large refund, from a financial standpoint, it would be well worth your while to reevaluate the withholding on your W-4. Though I must admit, Tess, from a psychological standpoint,
you
we can talk
refund.
About this to a, to a blue in the face. But taxpayers feel better if they get a refund, even if it's only their own money.
I love that refund, man. I would much rather have that.
Exactly.
All right. Frank Deegan, always great to talk to you. Happy holidays, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess, and best of wishes for a happy new year to you and all your listeners.
Has your debt gotten out of control? Are you constantly fighting with your partner over money? Well, then maybe, just maybe, you would qualify for the reality show Till Debt Do Us Part. It's a financial makeover show produced in Canada, airing here on CNBC. For couples at risk of breaking up over gigantic credit card bills and overdue car payments. And as fate would have it, someone behind the scenes has been struggling with some of the same issues. Sean Cole explains.
I should tell you a little more about the show first.
Money, 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 money.
It's hosted by the money guru Gail Vaz-Oxlade. Every week, she meets with yet another couple buried under an Everest of debt. Lovingly, she yells at them.
$57,000 in debt!
If you can't come up with the money to make the payments on the couch, why'd you get the couch?
Every month, you are overspending by $2,755.
Can you see why I think you're both morons?
Yeah.
Then she lays down the rules.
For the next month, this couple will learn to live on a strict cash budget. No more credit cards. They'll complete weekly challenges to tackle their money and relationship issues. And if they're willing to change, I'll reward them with thousands of dollars to pay down their debt. No changes, no money.
And a lot of them do change. They make a budget, stop overspending. They even get more cuddly with each other. I wanted to get behind the scenes somehow, just to see how it all worked. And then I was out at dinner with a new friend I met at a party, Mia McDonald. And I said, "What do you do for work again?" "I work for a reality show," she said.
Okay, so tell me who you are, name, age, and occupation.
Tracy Heron.
Maybe just make it a bit more personable and like, "Hi, my name is, you know."
Because it's just.
Turns out Mia has been casting director of Till Debt Do Us Part for almost 2 years. She pre-interviews the couples over the phone and then auditions them at their homes on camera, sort of a screen test.
Since we started fertility treatments years ago, we've accumulated approximately $120,000 in debt, if not more, but we're not really keeping track anymore.
How does that number, when you say it out loud, how does that feel?
It's kind of scary how much you can spend in.
It also turns out Mia's distinctly well suited to this job.
Just know I'm not judging you guys. I have my own debt. Like a lot of it, so.
An awful lot of it.
All right.
And since Mia's always recording couples telling their debt stories, I thought I'd record her telling hers.
My debt started with student loans.
She didn't really need them since she had scholarships and governmental aid. But everybody was taking out loans.
It was a $45,000 bar tab.
She graduated into film work in Vancouver as a personal assistant to big Hollywood types. She leased a Mazda she couldn't afford, rang up dinners and vacations on the MasterCard.
Not just the MasterCard, it was the MasterCard and the Visa.
Oh, okay.
And the other Visa. Luxury department store card.
And then work slowed down. This is all contract work, by the way, no benefits. And finally, she was driving with two friends on a movie set and smacked into a production vehicle in front of her.
I just remember saying to my two friends, "Are you guys okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, are you?" And I'm like, "No, I think you better go in." And then I just sat sobbing and sobbing. I had no credit left. I didn't have money to fix the car. If I relied on insurance, my rates would go up. They were already exorbitant. I was screwed.
Money, 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 money.
By October of 2005, I was $70,000 in debt.
It's fluctuated since then, down to $25,000 at one point, back up to $50,000 due to unpaid taxes. Right now, she's hovering around $30,000. But to Mia's boss at the show, all of these liabilities were a weird kind of asset.
She thought that because I had struggled with debt myself so much that I would be very good in casting because I really can't judge them. I mean, I'm just as impulsive and...
And impatient and optimistic. Of course, there are a lot of different stairways into the basement of debt. Take Tracy and Dan Heron, who you heard auditioning earlier. They probably wouldn't be in debt if it weren't for all of the fertility treatments. And finally, a surrogate mom.
We thought we'd be pregnant the first 15 grand. 15 grand is nothing. We can get pregnant and go move on.
Optimism.
Optimism, yeah. Exactly.
I'm telling you, since I've become more pessimistic about the future and cynical, I'm doing a lot better.
But Mia's also managing her debt better simply because of working on the show. For one thing, it pays pretty well. And for another, it's a show about how to manage your debt. She can't help but learn on the job. And yet, in one way, all of that learning can make it frustrating to audition people who are still in the dark.
We really don't know what the best avenue is to do. Obviously, we've...
For example, Dan and Tracy Heron bought some land north of Toronto, built a cottage on it, then mortgaged the cottage to pay for the fertility treatments, and now they want to keep the cottage.
The cottages aren't getting any cheaper.
No.
So for us to sell the cottage, we basically... Not that it would be for sure, but it would be unlikely that we'd be able to afford it later.
These people are $120,000 in debt. At this point, even I'm thinking, sell the frickin' cottage. Mia always wants to jump in at moments like this with her own advice.
And I bite my tongue because that's Gail's job. It's not my job. But it's just that I've learned a lot and I watch the shows. And by no means am I an expert, though, clearly. I wish I could be on the show sometimes.
But she doesn't qualify. She's single. Speaking of which, and this will give you a sense of how much debt has pervaded her brain, Mia was on a date last month, a first date, at a pretty expensive restaurant.
And when the bill came and I saw it, I was like, ooh. And he's like, that's okay, that's what credit's for. And I had to really check myself from going, you know, that's the kind of attitude that got me into trouble.
You like almost turned into the casting producer on your date.
It is hard to work on a show like this and not become that nag.
Except not long after I interviewed her, Mia's contract ended, and she signed on with another reality show in Toronto, a show about lavish, unapologetic spending. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is that time on the show when we take your questions. Here to help me out this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Are you having happy holidays so far, I hope?
I am. I love the holidays. Had a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner. I'm looking forward to the Christmas season. And so, yes, I like the holiday time.
Yeah. And is it sub-freezing there in Minnesota yet?
Absolutely. I mean, we have snow on the ground. My dog, 12 years old, loves the cold. Drives me crazy.
Then I suppose I shouldn't tell you that it's 75 here in L.A. today.
No, and I think you just put your dog out in the backyard, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I know.
All right. So given that we are headed toward the end of the year, you know, earlier in the show, we talked to Frank Deegan about how to prepare your taxes. But, you know, I wonder if you have some advice for some other things that people can do to prepare themselves financially for the end of the year and to get ready for a new one.
Well, you know, Tess, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a hectic time of year and there's all kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah.
But it's also a contemplative time. You're coming into a new year. You sort of look back. So one of my main recommendations is this is a time to get your finances organized. At least sort of, you've gone through your benefit season, right? Most people have. And now you're sort of going through the tax records and, you know, you're getting prepared on that side of things. So, you know, this is a good time to, where am I? What is my financial snapshot? And what are some of the things I need to put a priority on for next year?
So what would you recommend?
Well, one of the things that I do, I don't know if you do this, but one of the things most credit card companies now do and most banks, you know, they'll give you a statement about what your transactions have been over the year. And then it's very interesting. I enjoy going to mint.com or using the service that's offered by my bank to sort of look, where did I spend my money? And how am I doing on the savings front? So, you know, part of it is just going through all your financial records and just sort of see where you are. The other thing, and I just have to say this, we are a personal finance show.
Of course.
This is the holiday.
Uh-huh. I know what's coming.
The budget. The budget. Now, how much do you really want to spend? Not how much do you think you should spend, and let's budget for it. So you don't have that credit card financial hangover come January, February.
All right. Excellent sound advice. You know what's on my checklist? talking to our callers. So shall we go to the phones?
I think so.
All right. Well, believe it or not, another Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
We're doing well. You're calling from Sacramento?
That's correct.
And what do you do there?
Right now, I'm just taking care of my grandmother.
Oh, is she ill?
She's just up in her ages, and she's really frail, and she has a tendency to fall a lot.
Oh, my goodness. Well, good for you for helping her out. Is there a day job for you?
Right now, I'm currently looking for work. I've been unemployed for over a year now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. I used to live and work in New York City, but when the financial crisis hit, all the work dried up, and so I had to move back to California, and instead of moving in with my parents, I decided to move in with my grandma instead.
Oh, boy. Well, talk to us about what it's been like for you for the last year. We always hear, you know, the unemployment rate is around 10% and all these layoffs. And put a personal picture on that for us.
Well, for me, I'm young. I'm 25. I have my bachelor's. And, you know, it's been really hard. I mean, I do have a purpose since my grandma's not well. So I do have the free time.
Right.
But for me, I kind of need to get going with my own life now.
And what did you study?
I studied in philosophy. So.
So what's your plan?
Well, being a good marketplace listener, I went to the show's website and I spun your future job-o-matic.
Yes.
This is from
our
great.
This is from our sustainability desk. The future job-o-matic, and you can take a look at what the up and coming careers are.
Yes. That's correct. And it basically told me to go back to school.
Really?
Yeah, and that's the conclusion I derived from it.
So what exactly did it tell you?
Well, four of the top 10 highest paid professions in the future are science related. So that's kind of towards the position I'm leaning towards.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads into my question.
Okay, so you're looking at going back to school?
Yeah, but I'm wondering if it's financially feasible to do that. And I was just wondering if it makes more financial sense to go back to school for a second bachelor's in a science-related field or pursue a grad program such as a law degree or an MBA.
Wow. Complicated question, Chris. But my first reaction is kind of, well, what would you want to do?
Yeah, well, it's becoming less and less what I want to do and more about how to be competitive and successful in the future economy.
Yeah. But Chris, given that he has a philosophy degree, I don't know, would it be worth going back another 4 years to get a science degree?
Yeah, there's all kinds of issues. I mean, one thing, and Chris, which is a great name, I do like the name Chris, you know, you said something really important. You know, I applaud you, which is said you do have a purpose. And you have had a purpose, and you've done a lot of good during this period of time. In terms of getting the degree, how old are you now?
I'm 25 now.
So if you go back and get a science undergraduate degree, another 4 years plus a certain amount of debt, and then those higher paying science jobs, a lot of them require additional education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing is, you have to really love doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to be taking on that debt unless you have a strong idea what it is you want to do at the end.
Well, and you know, Chris,
which Chris are you talking to?
Yes. About. Yeah, exactly. Chris, caller, let me ask you, I mean, are you exploring this idea of going into science because you're interested in it or because you saw that it was a place to get a job?
It's more the latter than the former.
Yeah.
That changes the equation for me a lot.
Yeah.
And because it's so much time and it's so much work. And in the end, I think it just drains too much out of you. So, you know, I'd be very wary then of going and getting another undergraduate degree. So it's more playing around with what you're interested in, what your passion is, and if you want a little bit of, you know, income or stability, you know, it might be in the healthcare area where there's a lot of growth, might be in government. You know, perhaps there's sectors of the economy where you could find a place, and quite frankly, your BA may be enough.
So, caller Chris, what do you think? I mean, have you been actively looking for a job?
You know, I do actively look for a job, and it's more like it's a lot of no responses when I email them my resume and cover letter. And it's kind of discouraging when the best job I can get is just contract position.
Right.
I know. And you know what most people right now, I mean, particularly young people, are doing contract work.
Yeah, at least it's a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to tell you, caller Chris, that, you know, we are hearing stories these days that employers are looking for people who have gotten themselves yes. some sort of work experience while they've been unemployed and laid off. So I would say even if it's just a contract position, at least that shows a potential employer that you've been active.
Definitely.
Yeah. And you also have an important and good story to say why, yes, I've been unemployed, but here's exactly. what I've been doing.
Does that help you out a little bit?
It helps me out a lot. Thank you.
All right. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Tough question, Chris. Boy, so many people in that same boat.
There's so many people, and there are no simple answers to ask.
Yeah.
When you have so many people unemployed, you know, it's hard. But I really meant what I said is, you know, he is doing something very important. He's not sitting around. He's helping out his grandmother.
Absolutely. All right, let's move next to Carly, and she is in Berkeley, California. Hi, Carly.
Hi.
So what do you do there in Berkeley?
I'm a systems administrator.
So you help keep things running on time and
That's
well.
That's right. I yeah. keep the lights on.
And what do you do when you are not doing that?
Well, I do a lot of things. And one of the things I do is help run a soup kitchen.
Good for you.
That's
is that at a shelter somewhere?
My church has a monthly program.
Carly, have you noticed an increase in the number of folks that you're having to serve these days?
Oh, yeah. It's been a big increase since about August or September of 2008.
Yep.
A lot of first-timers, too.
Exactly. And folks who just never imagined they'd be in that position.
You can tell when they walk in the door. They've got that dazed look.
Right.
Bless their hearts.
Yeah. Well, you're spending a lot of time helping others, so give us a hint of how we can help you out today.
Okay. I had a good deed sort of blow up in my face.
Uh-oh.
Last Christmas, a friend of mine, they had no money, and they were about to get all the things they had in storage thrown away because they were behind on the payments for their storage unit. So I paid the back fees. Unfortunately, what happened is my friend's husband, and I emphasize he's now her ex-husband, told the storage company that my credit card was to be used for monthly billing.
Wait, so you used a credit card to pay off the back fees on this storage unit, and then he called and told them to keep putting the monthly fees for the future on there?
That is correct.
Oh, my goodness. What kind of money are we talking about? When did you realize this?
Well, it took me about 6 months to figure this out because I had put my credit card on auto pay.
Sure.
And, you know, I had a lot of other things on my plate and it just didn't ping my radar.
So what was the monthly fee then that you were paying?
$130.
Yikes. Okay. For about 6 months. Oh, Chris, this is not good.
Yeah.
That's not
and
good at all.
I challenged the charge with my credit card company and they came back and said, you didn't report your card lost or stolen. So too bad, so sad.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing you're wondering if there's any recourse for you, right?
Yeah, with the credit card company or if I can get this written off as a bad debt.
Yeah, well, so Chris, I'm guessing that the credit card company isn't going to be much help. Any other recourse
okay.
here?
Okay. I got a couple of suggestions. I would change my credit card. You can stay with the same company.
It has stopped.
I know it stopped. But I'm just being slightly paranoid that if somebody's willing to do what he did to you, I just feel let's just add an extra layer of safety so that 6 months from now or a year from now, this doesn't all of a sudden reemerge somewhere else on you. I think I would go back to the credit card company, but not directly back to the credit card company. I'd go to the merchant because this was not authorized. You made a one-time payment.
Right.
And you would dispute the charge. You do everything in writing. Then you go back to the credit card company. You say, look, I'm disputing it with the merchant. I followed all the procedures. And now I'm bringing it back to you. They then have to deal with it.
Okay. In writing.
Right. Then you have to decide whether you want to report this gentleman. Gentleman's probably the wrong word to use. Or do you want to take him to small claims court? Or do you just want to, you know, he's a bad egg and move on?
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your work at the soup kitchen. That's model human behavior. Thanks so much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and finally we have Lauren. She's in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How are things there in Lexington?
It's a bright blue day, but there's snow all over the place.
Oh, that's kind of like you, Chris, huh?
That sounds like St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do there in Lexington?
I just received my PhD this summer, and I'm on a postdoc at the University of Kentucky.
And what do you want to do with that?
Well, I'm hoping to be a professor. I really enjoy both teaching and writing. I'm working on a book right now, and it's just been so fantastic.
What's the book about?
It is about two black women in the 1920s and 30s, Juliette Daricott, and the other was Mabel Bird. They were also world travelers, and they were in higher education.
Hmm.
One of them is killed in a tragic car accident when a lot of African Americans got cars right away so that they could avoid Jim Crow transportation, but they weren't safe. And so then they were in car accidents, which then these brand new hospitals that were being built in the 20s did not admit these injured black people. So there's just a slew of car accidents with really tragic outcomes. And then the other woman actually goes on to work in the New Deal, and she is the subject of a conversation at a cabinet-level discussion about whether or not they should let her go south to do some research that they had hired her to do. And they end up deciding that, no, she's not qualified, even though she'd already done it. But she was a black woman, and they were afraid of what would happen if they sent a black woman south.
How did you find these two women?
It was one of those great big hunts where you start with a picture and a conference, and you see who was in that picture, and you just start connecting dots. And it took a long time, but it was really worthwhile.
Well, I think Chris and I could keep asking you questions about this forever, but let's get back to your question. What can we help you with there in Lexington?
Thank you. It's actually interesting. It's about a car. So I'm going through a divorce right now, and I kind of just started over from zero. I'm one of the very lucky few that I never had to take out any student loans, but I don't really bring anything out of the marriage, so I'm kind of at zero. No loans, but not really any savings either.
Okay.
And I don't have a car, so I've been riding my bike all around Lexington, which is meant it to be an environmental decision and a health conscious decision that I wanted to have this opportunity to see if I could make it. You know, could I live without a car?
And how's that going in snowy Lexington right now?
It's a little icy. It's a little cold. My eyelashes freeze while I ride to work. Anyway, I'd heard several years ago, probably on an NPR show because I'm an NPR junkie, about the Zipcar, which is this car sharing program.
I just used that actually when we were in Philly for our healthcare show.
Exactly.
We used a Zipcar and it worked out great.
So I'm trying to decide where the line is between using the Zipcar and using getting a car. Like, where is that financial line?
The economics of these car shares is actually quite powerful. And I remember years ago did an analysis. And at that time in New York City, where I was living, it made no sense to own a car.
Mm-hmm.
What it made sense to was if you rented a car every weekend, you still came out ahead.
Wow.
You know, what I'm thinking is, okay, so this is going to be a tough couple of months. Maybe you have to impose on some of the people you've met a little bit more. Maybe they have to drive in and see you a little bit more or take you home.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is probably a time to build up some savings.
Yeah, I was really excited last month because I was able to pay all my – it was expensive to move out here and set up a new household and stuff. And I was able to pay all my credit card bills off last month and start saving.
So I'd be making a list, you know, savings. You're going to be biking. You might be using the Zipcar more. Maybe there's some public transportation you can use every once in a while. You can,
mm-hmm.
you know, help out some friends. You know, I've known, you know, at times people, you know, they just fill the gas tank. Go use the car. I'm not using it. It's just, you know, sitting there. Go ahead. And they always fill up the gas tank. And that's very nice.
That's a good idea.
Sort of stitch your way together. Because what I'm actually kind of excited about is, what if you build up your savings? And then how long does this job last?
It's just a 2-year position. And then I'm going to go back on the job market.
So then you're back on a job market. So at that point, because if you end up in New York City, it's
yeah,
not going to
no
make
reason.
Much sense.
Yeah.
If you end up in certain parts of LA, it won't make sense. But do you end up in other parts of the country? You know, yeah, you're really going to need a car. Plus, you're going to have the savings. It won't be a strain on your budget. And it actually might make sense at that point.
All right. So does that help you make that decision?
It does.
What do you think you're going to do?
I think I'm going to hang in there and try to be tough for a while longer and also give myself the permission to use the Zipcar a bit more in the winter. Actually, on Sunday, I gathered up all the people who don't have cars and I drove us all to the grocery store. So it's a social
Perfect.
Thing, too.
Perfect. Well, tell you what, I want to hear from you at the end of the winter and see how it went.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll let you know.
All right. Happy holidays to you.
You too.
All right. Well, if you've got a question, do let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, stay warm, my friend.
Oh, I will.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Listeners know that we are big proponents of financial transparency, both on Wall Street and around the kitchen table. You have got to talk about money with your spouse, with your kids. But one place we're still not so sure about is the office. Ask yourself, do you really want to know what your coworkers make? Here's a sampling of answers from the streets of Los Angeles and New York.
I wouldn't want to know. Probably cause some resentment towards, you know, my fellow employees.
No, I don't. I just think that when you come into a company, you negotiate your salary and you were happy to take it, so you should be happy regardless of what others around you are making.
If they were there longer than me, if I was there longer than them, yeah, I would like to know what they were making.
I don't get paid a lot, so I don't really care.
Well, a group of Berkeley economists took up this topic recently. David Card is one of them, and I asked him how the study worked.
A couple years ago, the Sacramento Bee put onto a website a search engine which allowed you to look up the salaries of anybody who works for the state government in California, including everybody at the University of California. We decided to try and figure out whether finding out about that would change your value of how much you liked your job. So what we did was we took three campuses of the UC, and for the group that we're treating, we sent them an email and said, are you aware of this website where you can look up the salaries? And then five, six, 7 days later, we sent a second survey and said, we'd like to ask you some questions about how happy are you with your salary, how happy are you with the job? And on average, there wasn't too much difference. But when we focused closely on the group who were earning less than the median for the comparable workers in their pay unit, they definitely showed a pattern of feeling a little bit worse about their job and saying that they were more likely to look for another job in the future.
Well, that sounds kind of common sense, that if you find out you're making less than the median of your colleagues, you're not going to be real happy about it, right?
Yeah, although one of the big reasons why people earn less than the median for their pay unit is that they're less experienced or they're less qualified or they've been there less. So this isn't just that it's exactly comparable workers all doing exactly the same job.
Well, how do you think people would react if this kind of information was more readily available? Would that be a net positive or negative based on your findings?
Well, taken literally, what our findings suggest is if you have an environment where no one knows anything or very few people know, and then you suddenly make that information available, it doesn't do much for the higher earnings people. It does seem to be somewhat of a negative for the lower earning people, particularly the lowest. And presumably, over time, bosses and employers more generally would have to justify their pay structure.
Right.
And people would really have a better sense that whatever salary they got is pretty much out there in the open. It's like a athlete's salary. Everybody talks about it. Everybody knows what it is.
Right.
They might say it's too high. They might say it's too low. But at some point, everybody has a chance to kind of assess where their situation is. And they don't feel like the reason why I'm getting paid less is just because I don't have any bargaining power, or just because this particular employer feels that they can take advantage of my situation right now.
So do you think it's in management's best interest, perhaps on two fronts, to keep this information under wraps? One, it could force some changes in what they're paying people, perhaps truing folks up. But also, I wonder if they would have a less happy workforce if people did know what their colleagues were making.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what we see in our analysis. You're going to have some dissatisfaction, and we hope to be able to follow up our research in a couple of years and see whether the people that said that they're going to go out and look for another job, in fact, either do that or manage to get an increase.
Right.
Unfortunately, for those of us who work at the university, the last couple of years have been very tough economic environment. And so there haven't been any.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. When we started the project, it was actually just at the very peak of the cycle. We thought this is going to be really interesting. We can go a couple of years from now and see where people are, who got a raise, who didn't.
Right.
That didn't turn out.
Yeah, something like the Great Recession happened, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I have to ask, you were obviously work at the University of California. So did you go looking at your colleagues' pay? And how, if so, how did that make you feel?
I have looked it up. We figured we should do that just to sort of see how the website worked and also...
And how you reacted.
Well, to tell you the truth, you know, I'm a labor economist. I've worked on salary data for a long, long time. I don't think there were that big of surprises, but we have had the reaction from people who were sent the survey. And in many cases, people were rather surprised, both up and down. They said, well, I didn't realize, you know, what X, Y, and Z were paid, or I didn't realize quite where I stood relative to those people. So I think there is a lot of lack of information.
And I guess when you're thinking about the people who are at the top end, that the piece of bad news for them might be that they don't really have anywhere to reach for, that they don't have anywhere to go?
Yeah, that was all our alternative hypothesis, to tell you the truth. We thought if you look on the website and you see, well, you know, this guy's been here 4 or 5 years longer than me and his salary is $10,000 more than mine. Mm-hmm. People who find themselves a little below the median would be cheered up. Good news, you know, there's room to grow. On the other hand, I've been here a long time, and then I look at the other people who've been here a long time, and I see, well, in fact, you know, I'm doing really well. It doesn't look like I've got anywhere to go but down. Oh, my gosh, I'm stuck. And we find absolutely no evidence for that.
I have no sympathy for that whatsoever. I'd really love to be at the top.
Yeah. No, I have a feeling that that is the reaction from many, many people.
David Card is an economics professor at Berkeley, and we've been talking about his study, Inequality at Work, the Effect of Peer Salaries on Job Satisfaction. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Look around you. Look at all the things that surround you in your daily life. Got regrets about any of those purchases?
This shirt here, the tag is still on it.
It's a wok.
And the shower curtain I bought like a few months ago, and they kind of match.
I bought these earrings.
You know, so these are all my favorite lipsticks.
The waffle maker. It's in red, orange, little blazer coat.
Those were just a few of the items sitting on a large table at the front of Ann Choi's consumer education class. Her students at Cal State Dominguez Hills had scoured their homes for examples to use in the day's lesson.
The assignment was that you should have brought in, I brought my two things in, and then you had to wear something that you had some buyer's remorse over.
Buyer's remorse was the latest topic in a semester-long class on American consumerism. These returning adult students had already kept a journal for 2 weeks to track their spending. Now they were exploring regret over their purchases. Lynette Bell, a 52-year-old from Long Beach, held up a cast iron skillet.
I bought this in 2000, and I thought I was a Food Network chef, so that's why I bought it. And my others are lipsticks. Do you see me with lipstick on?
Choi, who's writing a book called Spent, Downward Mobility and the Middle Class, says this class teaches consumers to question why they're buying the things they're buying.
Everything is calculated and thought out to make us purchase things and then also for us to be constantly dissatisfied with the purchases that we make so we continue to buy. I'm not advocating that we shouldn't buy anything if we're buying for the right reasons.
Renee Acero, a 34-year-old from Southgate, displayed a purple velvet jacket, polka dot pants, sandals, a bath rug, and a shower curtain in her turn at the front of the class.
You know, I did notice that I was just buying things because they were a good deal, because I was bored. And so now I'm trying to not, you know, it's a good deal, but it'll still be a good deal if it stays in the store.
Paulina Martinez, a 30-year-old from Wilmington, opened what she called a huge duffel bag of regret, full of kickboxing clothing and gear worth $4,000.
Sometimes when I go into the store, I was like, maybe if I exercise enough this month, I'll fit into this.
Well, I think we also buy stuff because there is a particular version of ourselves we want to be.
And there was a lot of exercise equipment and one-size-too-small clothing on that table. Our buying habits aren't always about us, of course, but thinking of others can get us in just as much trouble. 44-year-old Michelle Ricketts of Lakewood told the class she's just a giver who can't stop buying things to give, like the coffee machine she plopped on the table. one of three sitting in the trunk of her car for the past 2 years.
Target had them on clearance, and they were all for $7. I'm not a coffee drinker. So I figured that, okay, I know that I will eventually be invited to someone's wedding.
So you're still waiting for the event?
I'm still waiting for that event.
I think we like the idea of also being prepared. We think that we don't have enough time, and so if you see something, you're going to buy three or four of them. But don't feel bad about it. That's how the system is supposed to work. You're conditioned in that way.
For most of the students, the day was an exercise in self-analysis. Joni Wilson, a 29-year-old from Los Angeles, had earrings, a jacket, and a computer antivirus CD with her. Well, that CD never made it out of the case.
I have a problem. I really do have a problem. Like, I didn't know before, but I really do have a problem with just accumulating materials just to have it.
I think we're primed to buy and buy more and buy continuously and never to really have any satisfaction. What my students are probably suggesting is that we can probably make better decisions and still be consumers and just have a better sense of why we buy the things that we do.
My boots.
This is a cake plate.
Earrings, a necklace.
So I have about 20 DVDs at home that have never been opened.
This is a can opener.
This dress, I bought two of them.
This yellow shirt is my buyer's remorse. I do not like the color yellow.
An excellent reason not to buy a yellow shirt. We've got photos of Ann Choi's class and that table full of buyer's remorse at marketplace.org. If you shop at Costco, I'm guessing you've had a run-in or two with buyer's remorse. How many giant boxes of Triscuit can a person eat? It takes a certain level of consumer competence to understand how to shop at a big box discount store. For those of you lacking that competence, commentator and New York Times columnist Ron Lieber has a few choice words.
Every time I'm at Costco or Sam's or BJ's, I find myself maneuvering around the lost tribes of the warehouse, people without a shopping list or any palpable sense of purpose. They veer and meander as if this were a locus of comparison shopping. No, please, go home. This form of consumerism is like the expert level on a video game, and there are rules here, lest the quest take an entire afternoon. What, you didn't know? Well, let's dispense with the rules then and get you briskly through the aisle, shall we? First, leave your kids at home. I have a kid. I love kids. But Costco is dangerous with its giant boxes and heavy carts. And no, do not let your kids stand up and ride in one. There are lots of food samples, and you are morally obliged to try every single one. But park your cart flush with the displays first, so the cart does not block the aisle. And park yourself out of the thoroughfare, too, as you blow on your soup or await the next batch of hot dumplings. Also, thou shalt not hold a place in the cashier line for someone else. You may get in line with your cart while someone else brings a few more items by hand, but you can't bring another cart or carts into line with you, no matter how many children you may have. Some customers seem to think that the opening of another lane is an occasion for a demolition derby of sorts, with people from three lanes over trying to jostle into position. No, this is how it will go. The people who have been waiting longest in the lines on either side of the newly open aisle get to fill in the new lane first. Then, others from two lanes over can move to the newly shortened lines that were there before. And so on. No bumper carts, okay? It sounds a bit exhausting, right? But it isn't supposed to be fun unless you find one of those cheap diamond rings that everyone is always talking about. But you can soothe yourself with this one final thought. If you buy enough paper towels and peanut butter now, you won't have to come back for a good long while.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Got your own suggestions for fellow shoppers? Well, comment on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org. And finally, dear listener, if you will indulge me in a holiday rant. Every year for the last 6 years, I've thrown a big holiday party at my house, generally send out, 70, 80 invites. But every year, more and more people decide to keep it a secret whether they're going to show up or not. They don't RSVP on time or at all. Now, there is a money angle here, and I'll get to that in a moment, but really, I'm kind of just hoping for an explanation. And for that, I turned to the most trusted name in modern etiquette, Emily Yaffe, who writes the Dear Prudence column at Slate.com. Want to come to my party this weekend, or would you rather keep me in the dark as to your intentions?
Tess, I will RSVP, even though at the time I should be leaving for your party, I find myself in my sweats laying on the couch. I will take a shower, get dressed, and show up.
Thank you. Now, I suppose I could assume that people just don't like my parties, but I would rather not.
It's not just you.
That is what I hear. I hear more and more similar stories from other people. What is this epic fail of RSVPs?
My mailbox is full of this. I think it's several things coming together. One, people just generally feel, oh, thank you notes, RSVPs, sure. You know, if I lived in Victorian England, I'd do that. And the other is because of the rise of email invitations and the reminders, everyone is kind of like a fifth grader, and you are their mother who's saying, have you practiced your piano yet? You must nudge them and nag them. Hi, did you get my last 5 invitations? Are you going to come? I don't know what the answer is, because there you are. You want to spend a lot of time and money to feed people, apply them with alcohol, and yet you feel like you're on the veldt and you're a big game hunter and you're trying to bag a wildebeest. Please come to my house so I can spend money on you. I mean, it's outrageous.
Well, and that really does get to the personal finance of this. Parties are not cheap. But if I haven't heard from you, I kind of have to assume that you might show up. So I'm going to buy more than I need and spend more money than I need to, right?
No.
Okay.
I assume if I haven't heard from you, you won't show up. And the other thing I hear all the time is that even if I have heard from you that you will show up, it's 50-50 whether you'll actually come. So I think what you have to do is, you say this is an annual party, you need to make kind of a mental note of who's RSVP'd, who's shown. And if year after year people don't even respond, knock them off the list.
Prudy, that's what I did this year. I did. I was very petulant. I did not invite people who did not RSVP last year.
Why should you?
That makes me the Grinch, right?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
What is it?
I don't know. I was really hoping you could tell me.
Is it TiVo or something? Everyone thinks they just don't live in real time.
I think maybe there's just always the glimmer of hope that there will be a better offer.
Well, there's not going to be a better offer than your party. That's for sure.
You got that right. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how the recession is changing the way we buy, sell, and live.
The word consumer, we're going to look back in a year or two, hopefully as sort of a term of ignorance and disrespect. It's almost implying a mindless, gobbling beast of indifference.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Special thanks this week to John Haas. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.